Now, the Grail King is in this story symbolic of the whole problem of the waste land. The Grail King did not earn his position. He inherited it. He was a beautiful young man. And one fine day, he rode out of the palace with the war cry, Amor. That's all right for a nice young man, but it's not the proper intention of the keeper of the Grail. The Grail is the symbol of the highest spiritual fulfillment. And he rides out on the level of chakra 2 instead of chakra 6. You know what I'm saying. So as he's riding out, he comes to a forest. And out of the forest comes riding a pagan knight, a knight from the Holy Land, near the place of the Holy Sepulchre. And these two knights, they place their lances and ride at each other. And the Grail King's lance kills the pagan knight, and the pagan knight's lance castrates the king. What is Wolfram telling us? Wolfram is telling us that the spiritual ideals of the Middle Ages, which distinguish supernatural from natural grace, has castrated Europe. The natural grace is not allowed. It is not what dictates life, the movement of the horse. It's this notion of some spiritual thing that comes by way of the cardinals of the church, tells you what's good and what's bad. Nature has been killed in Europe. The energy of nature, this is Wolfram's lesson, and he says it, has been killed. And the death of that pagan knight symbolizes it, and the impotence then, the spiritual impotence of the Grail King is the consequence. He rides back in terrific pain to the court, and the pagan knight's lance had broken off, leaving the head of the lance in the wound. And when the head is withdrawn from the wound, on it is written the word, the Grail. The meaning of this is the tendency, this natural tendency of nature is to the spirit. Whereas the Lord of the Spirit had rejected nature, the wasteland. How is the wasteland going to be cured? The answer is by the spontaneous act of a noble heart whose impulse is that not of ego, but of love. And love in the sense not of sexual love, but of compassion. That's the sense of the Grail problem. So here's this knight. This is the knight, this king, is the one with the peacock feathers in the boat. Parsifal on the shore says, look, it's getting late. Is there some place around here where a person could spend the night? And the king himself says, around the corner, you'll see a castle. Give a call. They'll let the drawbridge down. And if you can get there, and don't get lost, a lot of people go lost here, I'll see you tonight. I'll be your host. It all works out. He arrives at the castle. He's received with great expectation. Now, the interesting thing about enchantments, in case you're involved in anything of this kind, the people who are enchanted know how the enchantment is to be lifted, but they can't lift it. The one who is to lift the enchantment does not know how it is to be lifted. But by his spontaneous act, he does the thing that has to be done. So these people know that a knight will come and through the proper act, lift the enchantment. They think, here he is. I mean, this beautiful boy. That evening, there is an enormous festival in the great festival hall, symbolically rendered beautifully by Wolfram. And in the course of it, the king is brought in on a litter. He can neither stand, nor sit, nor lie. Do you know that line from T.S. Eliot, The Wasteland? He takes it right out of Wolfram von Eschenbach. Here one can neither sit nor stand, lie now. And the boy, here's the key now. This is the crisis of the story. Potiphar is filled with compassion and is moved to ask, "What ails you, uncle?" And immediately he thinks, a knight does not ask questions. And so in the name of his social image, he continues the wasteland principle of acting according to the way you've been told to act instead of the way of the spontaneity of your noble nature. The adventure fails. King is very cordial, polite, everyone knows what's happened. He doesn't. The king gives him a sword as a present. The host presents a present to his guest. It's a sword which is going to break at a critical moment, just as he broke at a critical moment. He's ushered to his room, put sweetly to bed, gets up in the morning. There isn't a soul in the castle. The place is completely quiet. He looks out the window. There's his horse with his lance and shield. He doesn't know what's happened. He goes down, gets on the horse. As he rides across the bridge is lifted just a little too soon so that it clips the horse's heels, and a voice shouts at him, "Go on, you goose." That line you'll probably remember from Wagner's Parsifal. Well, he spends the next 5 years trying to get back to that castle. He rides around, not knowing where he is, what he's doing, people cursing him. Arthur's court, meanwhile, has gone to find this great guy. So one fine morning, just in the early winter, he's riding on his horse very early in the morning, looking for the castle. He can't find it, although it's right where it was, and he's right where it was, but it's not visible to him. A falcon has killed a crow, and on the snow, the black feathers and the red blood and the white snow. And he sees this, and it reminds him of Conguero Moore's complexion. Red lips, her white skin, her black hair. And he's fascinated in a love trance. Meanwhile, Arthur's court has arrived in their pavilions and tents, and a young page looks over here, and here's this knight sitting on his horse just gazing at the snow, and he runs into Arthur's tent, pulls the covers off Arthur and Guinevere. There they are, stark naked, and he says, "There's a knight out there." Well, Arthur says, "Send someone out for him." So they send Sir Kay, who is the lout of Arthur's group. Sir Kay comes running out with his lance, and the horse, this marvelous horse, just turns, and Parsifal is still in semi-trance, throws the knight, who falls with a broken arm. They send another knight, Bedivere, he's thrown too. Then they send Gawain. Now, Gawain's around 36 or so. He's been around. He's known as the Lady's Knight. And he sees this, and sees Parsifal there, and he says to himself, "This is a love trance." So he takes his kerchief, big yellow kerchief, and just throws it so that it falls between the eyes of Parsifal and the sign on the snow. Parsifal's trance is broken. He looks, and Gawain says, "Greetings to Arthur's court. Come." So he brings Parsifal to Arthur's court, and the court is delighted, and they set up a picnic. They spread a great, big, circular tablecloth on the lawn, and knight and lady sit around this, and they're just about to enjoy this wonderful welcome, when on the horizon they see a tall, sort of pinkish mule, and riding on the mule is a lady with a face like a boar. And her hands are about as beautiful as those of a monkey. And she has a very fashionable London hat, which is hanging down over her back. This is the Grail Messenger. And she comes and she says to Arthur, "You are disgraced forever, receiving into your court this foul monster here." And she goes to Parsifal and says, "Despite the beauty of your face, you are more ugly than I." And then she tells what he did. And she said, "God's curse is on you." But this is, I have another adventure to suggest. There is a castle with 500 knights and 500 ladies that's under enchantment. Who will go on that? Well, Gawain takes that adventure, and Parzival just gets up, and when Gawain is leaving, Gawain says, I commit you to God. And Parzival says, I hate God. I have nothing to do with God. I thought I was serving God. I thought I was doing as I have been told was the sacred thing to do. And look what he's done to me. I'm through with God. And then he leaves and goes off on this quest. Well, there comes a moment in this quest when he comes to a hermitage. He comes to the hermit. The hermit says, come in, have dinner. When he sits down, the hermit says, let's say grace. Parzival says, I don't say grace. I hate God. The hermit, whose name is Trevor Cent, says, you hate God? Who's crazy here? He says, God returns manifold what you give to him. Give him love, and you'll have his love. Give him hate, and you'll have his hate. This is an interesting thought, that the relation to God is a function of you. Parzival tells him of the adventure, and he says, I'm going to go back to that castle. Trevor Cent says, you can't. The adventure must be done spontaneously. The first time, you can't go back and do it. Parzival says, I'm going to do it. He rides off. Well, the thing goes on and on and on and on. And finally, Gawain has rescued the 500 knights and the 500 ladies, and meanwhile has fallen in love. Now, this is a guy who's been with one lady after another, and finally he is taken. He's riding up a hill. He sees this woman seated with her horse nearby, and he is smitten. And he gets off his horse and he says, I'm your man. Oh, she says, don't be silly. I don't take things like that. He says, well, take him or not, I'm your man. She says, I'll give you a hard time. He says, you'll only be injuring your own property. And she does give him a hard time. It's a wild story. But here it is. Here's Gawain's commitment. The high virtue in all of this is loyalty. In love, loyalty. In marriage, loyalty. And this is the high virtue of this knightly affair. So finally, he solved all the problems for this really mad woman, and they're about to be married. So there's a great marriage of Sir Gawain with Arthur's court present, and the 500 men and women from the castle that he had disenchanted. And just at that time, Parzival arrives. And Parzival and Gawain, not knowing who is who, ride at each other and unhorse each other and then find who they are and so forth. And the invitation goes out to Parzival. We're having a wonderful time here. The marriage of Sir Gawain, be with us. Well, as Wolfram says, there was love and joy in the pavilions. And when Parzival saw all this going on, his own heart was loyal to Conwira Mors, and he couldn't stay there. So out of love for Conwira Mors, he leaves the greatest party the Middle Ages has ever seen, and goes riding away. And as he goes riding away, there comes riding toward him out of the dark forest a pagan knight. You see repetition of the old story? The two knights ride at each other, unhorse each other, go at each other with swords, and Parzival's sword breaks on the helmet of the pagan knight. Pagan knight throws his own sword away and says, I don't fight a man without weapons. Let's sit down. They sit down. They take off their helmets. The other knight is black and white. It's his brother. Wolfram handles that love in a beautiful way, of the brothers fighting, each out of honor, doing the other great harm, and so forth and so on. So they begin talking about their father. And Parzival says, well, there's a great party down the way. Perhaps you'd enjoy it. So they go back to the party. And Wolfram says, the ladies were particularly enchanted by the grace of the pagan knight, Parzival's brother, Fairfiz, probably because of his interesting complexion. One way or another, while they're there, there appears on the horizon a tall pink mule, and riding on it is a lady with a stylish London hat, face of a boar. She rides up to Parsifal and says, "Come to the Grail Castle. Through your loyalty, you have achieved the adventure. And bring your friend." Now, this is something. Very few Christians could come to the Grail Castle, but here's a pagan, here's a Muslim. The two come to the Grail Castle. What counts is your spiritual stature, not whether you were baptized or circumcised. So they come to the castle. The whole adventure takes place. The Grail Maiden comes in. Now, this is interesting. The clergy of that century, of that period, were a very immoral bunch. Pope Innocent III himself called them a sty of pigs. St. Augustine had fixed this up for them back in the 5th century when there was this heresy known as the Donatist heresy that declared that sacraments administered by immoral clergymen did not work. And Augustine said, no, the sacrament is incorruptible and it doesn't matter. So it didn't matter, and the result was what they had in the 12th and 13th century. The Grail Castle was not a church. The Grail was carried by the Grail Maiden, who was a virgin, and she was a virgin. And these were people who were what they were said to be. Not inauthentic at all. Well, she's a beautiful girl with that grail. And this Muslim, he had an eye for the girls, you know, that was the kind of story of the time. And people noticed that when the grail was brought in, he couldn't see the grail, all he could see was the girl. So they began to murmur and think, well, what about this? And they said, well, he should be baptized. Well, I thought when I came to this, now, Wolfram, don't let me down. And he didn't. An old priest comes in with a baptismal font that was empty, and it was made of ruby or something like this. And Wolfram says, this is an old priest who has converted and baptized many a heathen. And the baptismal font is tipped toward the grail, and it fills with grail water. Now, the name of the grail is Lapis Exilis, and that is the name of the philosopher's stone. And this is grail water that's going to do the baptizing. The pagan is baptized. He says, what's this? What's going on here? What are you people going to do? They say, we're going to turn you into a Christian. He says, what does that mean? They say, that means you give up your God and you accept our God. And he says, is your God her God? And they say, yes. He says, I'm a Christian. So that's that one. And so there he is, baptized. And then, not only does he see the grail, but there appears on the grail an inscription. And the inscription reads as follows. If any member of this community should, by the grace of God, become the ruler of an alien people, let him see to it that they are given their rights. I think that in the history of civilization, that's the first time such a thought has ever come in. The Magna Carta was 1210 in England, but that was the barons asking for their rights from the king. Here is the idea of the king is ruling, not in his name, but in the name of his people. So we have in Wolfram marriage for love, and love confirmed through loyalty in marriage, and the rule for the people. That's big stuff. Early 13th century. Then Parsifal asked the question, what ails you, uncle? The king is healed. Parsifal himself becomes the Grail King, representing the guardian of the highest spiritual value. The spiritual values are compassion and loyalty. And then his lovely wife, with now two little boys, one of them is Lohengrin, comes, and there's a beautiful scene of reunion. And then Trevor Tsent, the hermit who had said, "You can't do it," when Parsifal had said, "I am going to do it," Trevor Tsent says to him, "You, through your tenacity of purpose, have changed God's law." That's big talk. The God in us is the one that gives the laws and makes the laws, and it is within us.
At the conclusion of Joseph Campbell's lectures, it was not uncommon for members of his audience to seek personal guidance for their lives, or, on a grander scale, for the life of the planet as a whole. But Joseph Campbell's wisdom was not that of a therapist nor world savior. It was that of a scholar. As Campbell himself said, "Everything I know, I have gotten from reading." He offered no solutions to the world's problems, though surely solutions are implied. Nor did he offer the guru's path to spiritual enlightenment. Do not wear Joseph Campbell's picture around your neck. But Campbell was a storyteller, and if you pay attention to the stories he told most frequently, you can learn a great deal about Campbell's own way of life. And so we conclude this series with one of Joseph Campbell's favorite stories, told one evening at a church in Santa Fe, New Mexico.
This is the story of a tigress who is starving, hungry, and pregnant. And she comes upon a little flock of goats, and in pouncing on them violently, brings on the birth of her little one and her own death. She overdid it. The goats scatter and come back to their grazing ground. And when they come back, they find this just-born little tiger and its dead mother. Now, they have very strong parental instincts, so they adopt the little tiger, who grows up thinking he's a goat. He learns to eat grass, but he doesn't do very well with it because his teeth are the wrong kind and for chewing, and his stomach can't digest all the cellulose. So he grows up to be a pretty miserable specimen of his kind. When he reaches adolescence, a great male tiger pounces on the little flock, and again, the goats scatter. But this little fellow isn't a goat. He's a tiger, so he's standing there. Big fellow looks at him. He says, "What? You living here with these goats?" says the tiger. Well, the big fellow is mortified, like a father coming home, finding his son with long hair. He slaps him back and forth a couple of times. The little one bleats in a silly way and nibbles grass in embarrassment. Big fellow takes him by the neck and carries him to a pond, but the water is perfectly still. The little one looks in and for the first time sees his own true face. The big one says, "You see, you don't have the face of a goat. You have the face of a tiger. Your face is like mine. You're like me. Be like me." That's this guru stuff. "I'll give you my picture to wear." So he takes him up next and carries him to his den, and there are the remains of a recently slaughtered gazelle. Big fella takes a chunk of this bloody stuff and he says, "Open your face." The little one backs away. He says, "I'm a vegetarian." "Well," said the big one, "none of this nonsense." So he shoves it down his throat and he gags on it. And the text says, as all do on true doctrine, so gagging on the true doctrine, he's nevertheless getting it. And it gets into his bloodstream and it gets into his nerves, and his proper nature, now fed by his proper food, he gives a little tiger stretch. And out of his little mouth comes the little tiger roar, sort of tiger roar 101. And the big one says, "Okay, now we go into the forest and we eat tiger food." Now the lesson is clear, namely, we're all tigers living here as goats. And the function of the sociologist is to cultivate our goat nature and keep us aware of it. The function of meditation and such symbology as I've been showing you here is to introduce us to our tiger face. Now, however, we have a problem. We're tigers. How do we live as goats? Jesus said, "Don't throw your pearls before swine, lest trampling them underfoot they turn on you." And he found out about that. And so did Halaj, who was crucified also, because he too said, "I and the Father are one." So what are you going to do? You don't want to get crucified yet. The mystics, the Sufis, after the death of Halaj, got the message. Wear the outer garment of the law. Behave like everybody else. Obey the moral order. Agree, good is good and evil is evil, and so forth. But inwardly, you wear the inner garment of the mystic way. And so, you keep your wisdom to yourself and to those who are ready to hear it. And you move in the world, as the Buddhists say, with joyous participation in the sorrows of the world. So, I know that you will now go forth to experience with joy the sorrows of your lives.